You are tuned to The Sharon Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is feeling like an outsider. And a lot of us do feel like outsiders. And it helps us actually accomplish things that insiders don't, because for whatever reason, they have life a lot easier. Or so we think. Maybe if you're an insider and you suddenly lose your status for doing something unacceptable within that insider club, it's worse because you're not in any way prepared to suddenly become an outsider, to be shunned, to be on the wrong side of a lifestyle. Now, I don't usually get either political or particularly topical on this Sharon Hour show. That's intentional. I like to keep it more of a human interest kind of show that's sort of outside of any particular time. But I am going to bring up Billy Bush and what's going on at the moment with him and the whole Billy Bush with Trump on the bus thing. Billy Bush is obviously the ultimate insider, born into America's royal family, the presidential Bushes, born with money, born with a silver spoon in his mouth, a good-looking guy to top it all, with an enviable, well-paid job, hanging around celebrities, interviewing them for a network entertainment show. This other man is a guy who's a wealthy real estate tycoon, also born with a silver spoon in his mouth to money. He has a reality show and also produces beauty pageants featuring women desperate to get out of Dodge. Everyone's trying to make their mark, win the big prizes, whether it's more money or other beautiful people, all operating in self-interest at the time, we presume. Basically operating in the professional world as we all do. In Billy Bush's case, having to kiss A, having to smile and go along when someone says something inappropriate. We as women have always had to do that, or be called out as prudes or snitches or worse. There's always that Monday morning quarterbacking that says, "Why didn't you?" Well, because people don't want to lose their jobs. It's all very well being a martyr, but you've still got to pay the rent, and you're usually vilified, and even if vindication comes later, a lot of harm has already been done. Billy Bush confirms that he was going along with a guy that his job basically dictated that he had to go along with. Yes, he laughed at this guy's inappropriate comments, but look what happened. Just for laughing along, Billy Bush gets fired. The perpetrator of the disgusting comments, not to even mention the disgusting behavior that inspired them, goes and gets himself elected to the highest office in the land and maybe in the entire world, and gets to keep that job even after he lies, claims he never said what he said. Billy Bush at least told the truth, right? And lost his job as a result. Had he called Trump out at the time, he would surely have lost his job then too, because Trump had the bigger influence, albeit a shallow one at the time. His behavior and his comments didn't affect anything beyond that silly bus for a silly show. This man was not running the country. Anyway, the importance of the individuals aside, I have my own little homegrown version. I called a friend out for sending a kind of racist cartoon. She emailed me this cartoon. I found it distasteful. I'd found a few other previous ones distasteful, and I decided it was time to say, don't do that anymore. I was very fond of this woman. Still am. She has different views on life to me. But I decided to tell her I thought this was sort of offensive, in a way that everyone was claiming Billy Bush should have to Donald Trump. So how do you imagine that went down? I was careful to say, look, I love you dearly, but that kind of thing is offensive. She emailed back, I'm so sorry. I didn't really even think about it too deeply. It was just somebody sent me that cartoon and I kind of forwarded it on my email list. Okay, on the surface, everything cleared up, right? Of course not. She's now uncomfortable with me. I'm uncomfortable that I upset her. You know, there are attitudes she holds and values that aren't mine. She's also an extremely fun, kind, interesting woman, and I've kind of risked that friendship. So it's not easy, it's not straightforward. You know, we can't all be missionaries. We can't all foist our views onto somebody else. We have to accept that there are reasons why certain people hold certain views. Maybe they've never been outsiders. So maybe they've never felt the sting of being mocked or treated as a second-hand citizen. I can't say I have hugely in my life, but I have, being the daughter of immigrants, experienced chauvinism and bias because my parents spoke with a foreign accent, because my mother was rather elegant and imperious, and I wanted an English mum who was sweet and quiet and plain and just a mum. These are tiny feelings of being an outsider and foreignness in a country like England, in a country like America too, actually, in this climate, is something that makes you feel outside of the norm. I'm just saying, you know, look at Billy Bush. Okay, enough on that particular aspect of this topic of feeling like an outsider, which is the topic of tonight's KX935's Share Now with me, Sharon James. Nothing is static. Even an ultimate insider can eventually get to be an outsider.
I've been around the world, had my pick of any girl. You'd think I'd be happy, but I'm not. Everybody knows my name, but it's just a crazy game. Oh, it's lonely at the top. Listen to the band they're playing just for me. Listen to the people pay just for me. All the applause, all the praise, and all the money that I have made. Oh, it's lonely at the top.
You're tuned to the Share Now with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. My topic tonight is feeling like an outsider. And the funny thing is that no amount of success and fame stops you from feeling like an outsider, if you ever felt like one. And actually, fame and success can put you in the position of being an outsider, being not normal, being outside everyone else's experience. And yes, it can be lonely at the top. Jay Leno, the Tonight Show host and stand-up comedian who obviously reached the pinnacle of his game, has said, "I always felt somebody was going to call me out, that I'd suddenly be pulled to one side and told, 'You don't belong here, and what you're doing here, go away.'" So that feeling doesn't go away. And it's very common with performers, particularly comedians who turn tragedy and humiliation into comedy. Here's one of my favourites, English public schoolboy Jack Whitehall, an outsider in many respects because of his Tony upbringing, but here an outsider because he's a foreigner in a foreign country trying to make himself understood.
I went to Spain recently. It was a disaster, okay? I went to this restaurant. I needed to go to the restroom. I don't want to go into too much detail, but I needed to drop the kids off at the pool, all right? So I did that, right? I go to flush. It doesn't work. I flush again. Still not working. 5, 6, 7 times I try to flush this thing down. It will not go. So I'm like, oh, I'm going to do the right thing here. I'm not going to do a hit and run. I will go out and inform a member of staff that there is a problem with their facilities, all right? I go into the restaurant. I find a waiter. Unfortunately, I don't speak any Spanish. He doesn't speak a word of English. I end up having to kind of gesture to this man. I'm like, yes, could you just come here? No, sir, yes, just follow me. Ici, por favor. Yes, just in here. Yeah. I managed to usher him into the restroom, right? I pointed at my poo. I went to flush. It went down straight away. How weird did I look? Like I just invited a waiter into the restroom to say goodbye to my turd. Come on, let's give it a proper send-off. Flush. Rule Britannia. Britannia rule the waves. And it's insane.
So there's a new comedian on the block. And I was reading an article about her in the Times. Her name is Rachel Brosnahan, and this article is actually penned by Rachel Syme. And I'll read you the first paragraph. It says, stop me if you've heard it before. The one about the actress who gets the worst flu of her life. She has a fever that makes her feel as if she's underwater, that slips her into tiny blackouts, that makes her toes sweat. Her brain feels like a fog machine. She can barely remember her own name. Snotty tissues are stuffed down her pants and littering the floor. She's also about to do the most important stand-up comedy act of her career. She has to deliver 5 minutes of material midday to an almost empty room. The stakes are high but simple. Make them laugh. And she gets everything. But, and this is important, she's not a comedian. She doesn't write punchlines. She's really more of a self-professed dad humor aficionado. She laughs at farts and dopey puns in store names. She's never played a club. She's never even played a living room. And there she is, sloshing around in her heels, most likely contagious, telling jokes to 4 people who could change her fate. So, there's no punchline there. That's what really happened to Rachel Brosnahan. At 25, not a comic, but now playing one on Amazon Prime, when she walked into her audition for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. She could barely see straight and was, she told the writer of this article, Rachel Syme, probably deathly ill. But she had no intention of cancelling the meeting. She'd already pushed back her flight to Los Angeles once, hoping her illness would abate, when instead her temperature spiked. And the morning of her rescheduled trip, she woke up also clammy, disoriented, and completely terrified that if she didn't hurl her body out to Hollywood that day, Amy Sherman-Palladino and her husband and co-creator, Daniel Palladino, were going to give the part of the marvelous Mrs. Maisel to the next woman. And she wasn't going to let that happen. So she flew out to Los Angeles when she probably should never have been on a plane. But the thing was, she had a feeling in her bones that the role of Mrs. Midge Maisel was her part. Midge Maisel was a young Jewish housewife in 1958, straight out of Bryn Mawr, into a gleaming Upper West Side apartment with a doting husband who pitches ad copy by the day and wears transgressive turtlenecks by night. They have a toddler and a bouncing baby, and Midge Maisel has a waist that cinches into a Coke bottle shape in a permalift girdle. But of course, by the end of the first episode, Midge's idyll crumbles because no one wants to watch a show about a merry mid-century homemaker with zero problems. Midge's husband, amongst other things, has been sleeping with his svelte secretary, Penny Pan. Worse, the two are in love and he's packing his bags. In the show, after he leaves, Midge downs a bottle of red wine on the subway, marches through the rain to the famed Gaslight Club, and ends up on stage, soaking and soused in a pink swing coat. On stage, she mocks men coming out of the bathroom and veers so wildly between pathos and one-liners that the crowd doesn't know whether to laugh or flee. And for a grand finale, she whisks off her top, the cops are called, and she's hauled off to jail, screaming about how there's no way her husband's new lover can compete with what she's just exposed to the audience. And this is what Rachel Brosnahan had to do in the audition, this scene, at a time when she was dizzy and barely lucid. As life had it, her illness worked in her favor because she looked sort of damp and deranged the entire audition. She said she was sweating so much, it was a mess. And Amy, Sherman Palladino, the writer, kept having to stop her to tell her to powder her face. She says she thinks she may have had a small stroke. She literally can't remember a single moment of it. Now, Amy Sherman Palladino has a different memory of Rachel Brosnahan's edition, saying, "She blew in like a hurricane. Nothing shook. Her pages didn't shake. Her hands didn't shake. There was literally no fear." Her husband, Daniel Palladino, added that while they knew making actresses perform a stand-up set to a cold room was, quote, sadistic, they had to find someone who could wisecrack under pressure. And that turned out to be Rachel Brosnahan. Amazing. I guess part of the feeling like an outsider is being able to not show what you're actually feeling and even convey the absolute opposite. Feeling like an outsider is the topic of my Share an Hour tonight. That's for me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And I'm going to retell now a story by Catherine Heine that she wrote in The Times about being an American stepmother in Britain. She'd married a Brit, inherited his children, and they'd had their own. And she was in a carpool one day with her own son, Angus, and a friend of his, Nicholas. Angus was explaining to his friend Nicholas in the car that his dad, Catherine's husband, had been married before, and so he had two siblings, of whom she, Catherine, wasn't the mother, but she was his, Angus's mother, and she was also his little brother's mother. As for the other siblings, there was another wife somewhere, and Angus seemed a little shaky on those details when he was talking to his friend. So his friend Nicholas was trying to absorb all this, finally asked Angus, "So where's your real mum?" Catherine turned from the driving wheel and said, "I'm Angus's real mum." Nicholas said, "So not that other lady?" "Nope, not that other lady." Nicholas thought for another minute, and then he said to Catherine, "You don't seem like a real mum." "Why not?" she asked. "Well, you're not serious enough." Catherine says she thought about this and realized that had been an issue in her life, not being taken seriously. But she thought she could at least fool a 10-year-old. "I am serious," she told Nicholas. He looked doubtful. He said, "You drive us to school in your bathrobe." "Well, that's actually a sign of how serious I am," she said. "I'm not bogged down by the superficial or distracted by shallow worries about my appearance." Angus quickly jumped in. He said, "I thought it was because you had trouble getting up in the morning." "That too," Catherine admitted. "Remember that time, Angus started, when you had to go into the bank in your..." "I think we should be quiet now," Catherine said. "I need to concentrate on driving." "So one more thing," chimed in Nicholas. "Are you part of the main family, or are you just sort of stuck on the side?" And Catherine realized that was a pretty good question to ask. She said, "I don't think anyone grows up wanting to be a stepmother. Stepmothers have a bad rap in every fairy tale I know." She explained that when she met her husband, Ian, in New York City, when she was 26, stepmother wasn't on any of her wants lists, nor was mother, really, even wife. But Ian was a divorcee with two children who went to boarding school in England. But for Catherine, that simply added to his appeal. 3 years later, she moved with him to London, where they lived in a red brick house with French doors leading to a charming little garden. At the time, his children, her stepchildren, were 15 and 13 years old and still in boarding school, but could come home at weekends. She said, "I wonder now how I imagined us all living together in that house. I really didn't. It was like someone who shows up at a bridge tournament saying, 'Oh, I didn't know we'd be playing cards.'" She hadn't wanted to play cards. She'd wanted to play house. Just a quick reminder here that you're listening to The Sharon Hour with Sharon James on Laguna's KX935. I'm talking about feeling like an outsider, that you don't belong. And I'm reading a story by Catherine Heine about her experience in that regard, becoming a stepmother, the mother of someone else's children, and moving to a different country, and having teenagers who you don't really know move into your life in your house. She explains, "Everyone knows teenagers can be disrespectful, sarcastic, ungrateful, self-righteous, superior, and lazy. Now, imagine being a teenager and living with a 29-year-old woman who's disrespectful, sarcastic, ungrateful, self-righteous, and superior. She says she wasn't lazy, but only because she couldn't afford to be at the time. She explained that there was a lot of conflict. It simmered, then boiled over. Being snide was everyone's favorite weapon. No subject was too small to argue about. Vacuuming, laundry, taking out the trash, eating the last chocolate biscuit, using the last square of toilet paper. An argument about forgetting to put the milk back in the fridge could last for weeks. She was writing young adult novels at the time, and she said she was writing with such suppressed emotion that she wore the letters off her computer keyboard. One way or another, her entire life revolved around teenagers. She lived with them, wrote about them, and, as she finds it painful to admit, had the emotions of one herself. She said she wanted what every teenager wants, to fit in. But she was an American amongst Britons, a writer amongst radio listeners, a peanut butter eater amongst Marmite fans, someone with a Midwestern twang living amongst plummy British accents. She was also 16 years younger than her husband and only 14 years older than her stepson, and she felt in limbo in that area too. So they adopted a sweet yellow lab, a very patient one, called Brandy. And suddenly there was something everyone could agree on, which was how much they all loved her. A lot of the conversation could bounce off Brandy, as in, Brandy loves it when we watch TV together. Brandy doesn't like it when you go into your room and shut the door. But at least it got them all talking. Catherine's man, Ian, got posted to Washington, D.C., and they decided to get married just before the move. They asked the local vicar to perform the ceremony, and she said, "Of course, I marry anyone, no matter how scandalous." The stepchildren attended, as did Brandy the Labrador, and Catherine got pregnant the following year. She was somewhat nervous about how her stepchildren would take the news, but their reaction was they made her promise never to send the baby to boarding school. She said it was a difficult pregnancy, and by the time Angus was born, she was unprepared for how much she'd love him, and entirely unprepared for how much her stepchildren would love him. One of her favourite of all the newborn photos is her stepson holding Angus for the first time. Then her stepdaughter flew from London to Washington, just for the weekend, just so she could hold him. She stroked his spiky newborn hair and his long eyelashes, then looked up at me and said, "I can't believe there's someone who's half us and half you." "Oh," she thought, "so there's still an us and a you, but at least no one said, 'Look what you had,'" which is what she'd feared. Then a second baby, Hector, came along, and by the time he was talking, he asked, "Why are you Catherine Heine, and why do you got blue eyes?" Because everyone else in the family had Catherine's husband's last name and brown eyes, and even a toddler could tell she was the outsider. When they moved back to London from Washington, her stepchildren were now in college, and she doesn't know how she would have managed without them, because it was difficult for her children, Angus and Hector. But having their brother or sister drop by was a sure way to get them to smile. They loved Catherine's stepson so much that they'd start crying when he arrived to visit, already sad about his upcoming departure. They moved to the Netherlands, and her stepchildren came for Christmas, their first year there. And on Christmas Eve, they all decided to bundle up and walk on the dunes. Catherine went upstairs to change, and by the time she came back down, they'd all gone ahead without her. She said she was furious, and more than furious, she was wounded. She thought, "Of course they left without me. I'm so forgettable that no one even notices if I'm there or not." Not only had they left her, but they left the breakfast dishes too. She said she loaded the dishwasher so forcibly that she was surprised the plates didn't shatter. She says now, in retrospect, she thinks everyone probably left when they did because they'd finally managed to stuff the young boys into their snowsuits. And with small children, it's all about forward momentum. And when they came home, they were contrite. "It was really fun. You should have been there," my stepson said, so mock innocently that I had to laugh. "He's always actually been able to make me laugh," she says. Her stepdaughter did the dinner dishes while Catherine took a bath, and peace was restored. But it was amazing how quickly she'd reverted to feeling like an outcast. Angus and Hector are teenagers now, and they live outside Washington again. The teenagers leave moldy sandwich crusts in their bedroom, use up all the hot water with their endless showers, and yes, leave the milk on the counter, Catherine says. But who cares? Not her. Brandy would be proud. Catherine seems to have gained a lot more patience. Or maybe it's just that she's been through the teen years with her stepchildren, and she herself has come of age. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And my topic tonight is feeling like an outsider. And it's always struck me as extraordinary that people who are excruciatingly shy, because they do feel that they're different from everyone else and won't be accepted if they speak out and or reveal themselves in any unfavorable light, can actually become performers and stand up on a podium in front of us all, ready to be rejected. I mean, most of us can't do that, right? But the reward for connecting is so strong that they're willing to give it a go. I can only use the analogy of, think of someone right now who you most want to impress. They're the person you really want to love you and think you're wonderful and think the sun rises out of you. Now imagine making that person laugh, being the joy bringer, just little you being able to do that for somebody who you admire and want on your side. And that's probably the motivation for most stand-ups, saying, look, I recognize what you're going through, and I found the fun in it. We all know that expression, tragedy plus time equals comedy, because tragic experiences are vital experiences, and vital experiences are loaded experiences, and they contain everything, pleasure, pain, and all sorts of interesting stuff. With comedians, they don't have to wait for the time. They can just attitudinally figure out the comedy in the situation and the humiliation and pain, because they recognize the humanity in it all, and it makes them feel at one with everyone. Still, if you're a stand-up getting up on stage, risking instant criticism, yes, you can get the laugh, but you can also get the groans and the heckling and the boos and the get off stage and the people turning away to talk to their neighbor and having no interest in what you have to offer, and all for the possible reward of people recognizing themselves in you and thereby recognizing you and having your view on life be accepted and part of the common experience, not something strange and isolated, an insider experience and not an outsider one. Feeling like an outsider is my topic on tonight's Sharon Hour. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Here's one of those brave, shy women who attempted to stand up, although she was painfully shy, to feel more of an insider than a permanent outsider. Her name's Shapi Korsandi, and this is her from her TED Talk.
I always felt like a misfit. I always felt like an outsider. But my job as a stand-up comedian gives me an identity that I feel so comfortable with. Now, what do I mean when I say outsider? It's not a willful state of being. Human beings need to feel like they belong. And I never really felt like I did. If I just talk personally, socially, I found things extremely difficult whenever I was at school. I remember not being able to speak English. I was born in Iran. I moved to Britain when I was 4 and a half, and I thought English was a series of sounds that people made up and other people magically understood, and yet they didn't understand when I went up and spoke gobbledygook. That feeling of not having a tribe was very potent in my life. Jobs at school, post-graduation, call centre work, I found it baffling how other people would find it so easy to find a companion for lunch, whereas I found that the idea of asking a casual acquaintance if they'd like to have lunch with me, the same as sort of asking them to marry me. It was as awkward. When I was about 16 or 17, I was at a dinner when I didn't know anyone. The one person I knew was at the other end of the table, and they were university students, slightly older than me, and I was trying to hold my own, but I couldn't be heard. And I remember that profound feeling of almost crippling shyness. I couldn't open my mouth to speak. If someone spoke to me, nothing would come out. I felt like I was underwater and everybody else was on the surface, and I had to leave dinner early because, not deliberately, just tears came from my face from shyness, and my face was burning, and I was thankful that I am Middle Eastern. No one noticed the hotness of my face as visibly as they might have done otherwise. And everyone thought I was pretty strange.
When you're strange, faces come out of the rain. When you're strange, no one remembers your name. When you're strange, when you're strange. People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down. When you're strange, faces come out of the rain. When you're strange, no one remembers your name. When you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange.
Strange. You only have to be a little different to be strange to others, to be an outsider. That's the topic of my Sharon Now tonight, with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. And you're currently listening to Iranian comedian Shapi Khorsandi expound on that syndrome.
It's a very painful place to be when your world is a different shape to everybody else's, and I think that's why I love stand-up, why a job where I'm making something out of nothing works for me, because then I'm creating my own world, and I'm inviting people to come into that, because I understand my world, so I want to invite people to come into mine and hopefully make them understand my world, and sometimes it goes horribly wrong. The experience of walking off a stage to the sound of your own footsteps. My favourite outsider is Holden Caulfield, the catcher in the Rye. He says, everybody sticks together in these dirty cliques. The guys that are on the basketball team stick together. The Catholics stick together. The intellectuals stick together. The guys that play bridge stick together. Even the guys that belong to the Book of the Month Club stick together. And I got Holden. I really did, because I didn't know how to be in a clique. If I ever was, briefly, it was only ever as a tourist, never a native. I would be with the clubbers. I'd be with the bookworms. I even joined the gay society at university without being gay, because they looked like they had fun. I mentioned the word native. I think that's quite a crucial thing in my experience. I wasn't born in Britain. I was born in Iran. We got refugee status in Britain by 1986. Our papers came through and we were naturalized. So I was then natural. Before that, I was officially an alien. And the reason we came over was because my father goes against the grain. My father is the satirist Hadi Khorsandi, and he was outlawed by the regime in Iran for opposing it. And we moved to Britain. And a profound experience that we had in Britain was, and this was not unique to our family, I have to stress that, was that we became targets abroad of terrorism endorsed by the Islamic Republic of Iran. And in 1984, Scotland Yard uncovered a plot to assassinate my father in London. Now, telling people that even now makes me feel like that weird kid at school. It just seems like a bizarre thing. but it was very real to us, and we had to go into hiding for a few days. And when I was researching my book, I went to The Hague, where there was a trial and some evidence of my father's would-be assassins came to light. And in court, they were described as a fat man and a very fat man, which upset my father, because if you're going to be assassinated, you want some slick Alan Rickman type to do it, not Tweedledum and Tweedledee huffing and puffing to the getaway car. I found a transcript of my father's death order, and it was signed by none other than the Ayatollah Khomeini himself. And on it was written, "The writer, Hadi Khorsandi, is to be shot as he takes his children to school." And in bold, it was written, "The children are not to be harmed." Now, that was amazing, because I'd written the Ayatollah a letter. When I was 11, I'd written to him and I'd said, "We're getting death threats at home. Please don't kill my dad. Why don't you come to London to meet him? He's very nice and he makes jokes up about everybody, even me. Our address is 65A Madeley Road." Now, he never wrote back, but when I saw that they'd said the children are not to be harmed, I thought, oh, he got my letter. Now, after this incident, my parents said, "You are not to tell anybody at school what's happened." I was like, "Why? Is it classified information? Are we still in danger?" And they said, no, they'll just think you're odd. And that's the feeling that we grew up with. We were just a little bit odd with all this stuff going on at home, not to mention the fact that we didn't have cheese sandwiches. We had like cotlet, this bizarre green stuff coming out of pita bread for our packed lunches.
It's funny. I know exactly what she means. Food and your parents' food choices when they're foreign does make you feel like an outsider. In London, my parents used to take me to a Czech restaurant called Chada in the West End, and I would order fish and chips because we never had them at home. Imagine being envious of English food, but I was. I'm Sharon James. This is The Sharon Hour on Lagunas KX935. My topic tonight is being an outsider, and we're currently listening to stand-up Shapi Khorsandi and her story about feeling like an outsider, not just because she was foreign, but because she was painfully shy and desperate to know how to fit in to the social order surrounding her.
So much of my life growing up, I spent in a state of bewilderment. And yes, culturally things affect you. Racism, of course, affected me as a child. A few things make you feel more of an outsider than when you're a little kid, maybe 5 or 6 years old. And I remember a car load of people, I think they're called, actually slowed their car down, adults, to shout to my mum and I, a young woman with a 5-year-old daughter, me, "Go home, go home." And I tugged on my mum's sleeve going, "Mummy, we only live up the hill. Tell them we're going home." And I realised they were being hostile towards me. Rental ads for house shares alienate us. I would read them and people would be stipulating professionals only. This is in my 20s and I was trying to make my mark in London, scuttling around on the comedy circuit, trying to get 5-minute gigs here and there. Professionals only is just a bit more PC than saying no chavs. But the message is clear. No riffraff and no DSS, which was a problem for me because I think I was riffraff and DHS. I found these ads very intimidating when I was looking for a place to live. In the end, to fund my years as a fledgling stand-up comedian, and also when I was a student as well, I worked as a cleaner in an old people's home, and it was a time in my life when I felt like I truly belonged. I was doing something good. I was hanging out with humans. I was serving humans. I was not the object-driven, time-poor corporate wage unit that my jobs in call centres subsequently tried to fit me into.
Now I go into cleaning to earn an honest bob. For a nosy parker, it's an interesting job. Now it's a job that just suits me. A window cleaner you would be if you can see what I can see. When I'm cleaning windows, honeymooning couples too. You should see them villain coo. You'd be surprised at things they do. When I'm cleaning windows, in my profession I'll work hard, but I'll never stop. I'll climb this blinking ladder till I get right to the top. The blushing bride, she looks divine. The bridegroom, he is doing fine. I'd rather have his job than mine. When I'm cleaning windows, There's a famous talky queen, she looks a flapper on the screen, she's more like 80 than 18. When I'm cleaning windows, she pulls her hair all down behind, then pulls down her never mind, and after that pulls down the blind. When I'm cleaning windows, in my profession I'll work hard, but I'll never stop. I'll climb this blinking ladder till I get right to the top. An old maid walks around the floor, she's so fed up, one day I'm sure she'll drag me in and lock the door. When I'm cleaning windows,
love that old George Formby song. Back to stand-up comedian, former cleaning lady, Chapiko Sandy, talking about doing an independent, honest job that sat well on her. This is from her TED Talk. We broadcast here on KX935 Sharon Hour.
What I found with working on the comedy clubs, even though I was getting very little money, what it meant was I had the freedom to be vulnerable. I had the freedom to be myself. I had the freedom to fall flat on my face and it not working and having no one to answer to but myself and the odd club owner. I recently, perhaps unwisely, got into a row with neo-fascists on Twitter. I spend a lot of time on Twitter and I do get trolled. And if I get trolled, people say to me, the only reason you've got a career is because you're a woman and from Iran. Why, yes, yes. As everyone knows, these are the two key things that one needs for a successful career in show business. At least these guys on Twitter were honest with me. They were honest by shouting at me and saying that you're an outsider. Usually what we're faced with is a reactionary columnist on a tabloid who will go to pains to deny being racist. One of the accomplishments of the right-wing opinion formers is to assume the stance of an outsider, while actually being eminently conformist, working for the man. Some of these columnists write as though being white and being privileged and working for a right-wing newspaper for an awful lot of money works against you. They talk about this as though it's a disability. The function of the right-wing columnist is to contest the outsider status of the vulnerable, because if the true extent of their plight is expressed, it can cause political problems for those leaders who they serve to protect. They're there to protect capitalism from the accusation that it's unjust and that it leaves people behind. When you are a vulnerable person, when you're a vulnerable outsider, now you have a fight on your hands against the blinkered worldview of the hard done by, this idea that the dominant culture is being threatened by these pesky minorities, whereas actually the feeling of being an outsider is a human thing. We all experience it at various times in our lives, or perhaps perpetually. It really has nothing to do with who lives next door to us or how many refugees are around us or whether or not they go to school with our children. This disconnect that we have with our actual selves is something that worries me about our society. But the good thing is that things like yoga exist now for everybody, in psychotherapy. These things exist because so many of us feel an outsider to ourselves, to the person that we are at work. And again, one of the freedoms of being a comedian is that I feel able to say, my life is baffling, the world is baffling, I feel terrible, and I have no idea what I'm doing. Isn't that a wonderful place to be? Because as a stand-up comedian, it doesn't matter who is in the audience. It could be a neo-Nazi, it could be ET, it could be someone that on paper I will have nothing in common with, but I have an insatiable desire to communicate with people who aren't necessarily on paper the same as me, because I like to find that common ground. And when I find that common ground, when I find that it works and I make that connection, because my job is a conversation. If I speak and you laugh, that's a conversation. If I'm able to do that, it makes me feel alive and it makes me feel human. And it makes me feel that I've created a world where I invite people to share their spirits with me for however long that may be. And it makes me feel like I'm the cool kid in the playground at last. And it's It's a job that I dreamed of doing as a child, but it was as realistic as saying, oh, I want to go and live on the moon. It didn't seem like a realistic career at all. But I'm so glad that I was able to find a way into it and make it work for me.
Don't be afraid of the man in the moon, because it's only me. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky.
I guess to be an outsider and acceptable, you have to become a great performer. That's all there is to it. How we miss our David Bowie. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Outsiders is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. Many of us are born feeling outsiders. Some are made. Here's Grace Quintock's story from her TED Talk.
I'm sure that I wasn't the first student to lie dazedly on the floor, words slurring, world spinning, struggling to stand. But in my case, it wasn't Friday night at the Union. I was lying on the sixth floor landing in the humanities building trying to get to my history seminar. And I wasn't drunk, but disabled. As I lay there, looking up, watching my peers walk past me to class, I wondered how on earth I ended up in that position. And to tell you how that happened, I need to go back a little way first. There are few things more devastating to a young girl on the cusp of making her mark on the world than having her dreams wrenched away. I was that girl. Like so many others, I was normal. I had hopes and dreams. And then suddenly, I wasn't. I was diagnosed with chronic and serious autoimmune illness at the age of 18, and my life was swept up in a whirlwind of pain, struggle, and confusion. I felt that even showing up to life was impossible in my state. And so I ask you now, where have you felt that life was impossible? And where have you felt an unwanted otherness? I felt my otherness most strongly when planning a simple shopping trip. To go shopping, first I needed to get out of bed. Believe me, big task. Then, of course, I needed to get dressed, which, with painful joints and aches and issues, was very, very challenging. Making a shopping list while living with memory loss and cognitive dysfunction was another challenge, but then, the biggest struggle, getting to the bus stop. And so I'd come out of the house and stumble up the street, holding on to the walls of my neighbours as I went by. You know, people are very inconsiderate when they plan their fences. I mean, if you're planning a garden fence, please let me tell you, because it's a challenge. I mean, some are low, some are high, some are spiky, and that's just mean. The ideal is a box, nicely trimmed, so I could just kind of topple into it, bounce back up, and stumble onwards. But then even when I got to the bus stop, there was otherness. There was challenge. People would stare at me and look at me. I'd be forced to justify and to defend my otherness, to explain. My dear, what's wrong with you? You're so ill, but you're so young, you're so ill, and you're so young. Over and over. All I wanted was to go shopping just like them. All I wanted was to be normal. And I felt like the only way to achieve normality was to not be ill anymore, to not be other. And so I sought a cure. And I was told by my doctors that there is no cure, to go home and get used to living like this. But of course, it wasn't really living, was it? But this story is not the girl in the wheelchair made good. It is living well and not a miracle cure story, which is my happy ending. And this story isn't just about me. It applies to us all, wheelchair or not, illness or not, because we all are human, we all struggle, and we all carry wounds in our own ways. And this story is not about fitting in, because when you embrace your otherness, you can do so much more. But history is full of misfits, full of those who are physically or psychologically imperfect. Full of people who have somehow managed to embrace their otherness, to accept their challenges, and then to go further. They are not defined by what limits them. They are instead defined by the greatness of their accomplishments after their so-called otherness. Artist Frida Kahlo, freedom fighter Malala Yousafzai, Paralympian Tani Gray Thompson, and all the other unsung misfits. I, of course, cannot compare myself to Frida Kahlo because I'm afraid that my self-portraiture is strictly limited to hashtag selfie. And I cannot claim one iota of the courage of Malala Yousafzai because after I read Harry Potter, I need to hide under the covers because I'm really, really scared that Voldemort is going to come and get me. And as much as I adore moving, the athleticism of the Paralympian Tani Gray Thompson, can't approach it. But I do identify with their seeking and gaining acceptance and meaning after the unwanted, unimagined, and irreversible otherness which they lived through. A few years ago, after being told no cure, I was talking to my friend and we were sitting and deciding, well, we'd just give my body a bit of a chance, try and set up the best possible environment for healing. Let's see what happens. I was eating a much more anti-inflammatory diet on the grounds that if I ate more anti-inflammatory food, I could take less anti-inflammatory painkillers. So as we sat there talking about this, her brother popped his head into the room and looked at me and said, Grace, that is disgusting. I said, okay, what? And I thought, okay, my hair is messy, but, you know, it's not heinous, and I'm actually wearing all my clothes. What? And it was my jar of green, bright, virulent vegetable juice, which he considered disgusting. And in that moment, I felt like such a weirdo and such a misfit and such a freak. And I was fed up of always being on the edge and always being the one doing those weird, crazy healing things that nobody had heard of and we weren't sure about. And it hurt. And I went home and said to my husband, who was crying, said, I'm fed up with always being the sick chick, always being the weirdo. And he said, Grace, what if you aren't? What if you aren't the misfit? What if you're the pioneer? What if you aren't the freak? What if you're the trailblazer? And that moment changed everything for me.
You're listening to Grace Quantock in her TED Talk on tonight's KX935 Share An Hour. Grace suffers from an autoimmune disease, and my topic tonight is about being an outsider. And there's nothing that makes you feel more like an outsider than looking physically different in a way that's unexpected and frightens people.
However, I do not believe that brokenness is something that we have to live up to. It's not a badge of honour. So living with a wound does not oblige you to be an inspirational speaker, despite evidence to the contrary. In fact, I believe that living day to day as yourself and loving yourself exactly as you are is a revolutionary act for a misfit. But what if the very idea of a misfit is a myth? You see, there's a concept that if we work hard enough and we try, if we buy the right books and we go to the right classes, if we buy the right clothes and we pay enough of the money to the right people, then one day we too will become perfect and we too will fit in. But misfits make mistakes and magic. Perfectionism is the opposite of the pioneer. Recently, I struggled with what the doctors thought was a stroke. After years of dedication and progress, it felt like everything fell away again. I lost almost all sensation and a lot of the strength and movement in the right side of my body. I had to learn to write again. I had to learn to walk again. But in that moment when part of me didn't even fit with the rest of me, the day they released me from hospital, I found and commissioned an artist to paint henna and paint beautiful artwork on the part of my body that I could not feel. And in that way, I reclaimed, I embraced and accepted the part of myself that I struggled with. And I believe that it's when we accept ourselves that our internal, emotional miracles happen. But I have been blessed and privileged to do amazing things. Things that the girl I mentioned at the beginning would never have thought possible. I set up 2 international businesses. I help people worldwide learn to live well with illness and struggle. If I had been spending that energy trying to fit in, I would never have been able to be an advocate for women, for people with disability, for misfits and for pioneers on the scale that I have. And so maybe you are dealing with your own wound and your own struggle. Maybe you're dealing with pain and disability like me. Or perhaps it's alcoholism or family dysfunction or poverty or homophobia is something that's happening against you or racism or whatever's going on with you. But I believe deeply and truly that we are all trailblazers. We with the broken bits. So no matter what part of you feels broken, no matter what part of you feels inferior or like a freak or a misfit or is struggling, I ask you in this moment to pause and to check in with yourself and decide which part of yourself you are going to transform from misfit to pioneer status.
And it's usually the outsiders that are the pioneers in the end, isn't it? The ones who don't take the norm for granted. Anyway, that's just about it for the Share An Hour tonight on being an outsider. It does have its benefits, doesn't it? If you want to hear this show again or any of my Share An Hours, you can either do it on iTunes, Google the Share An Hour, that's Sharon without the G, a pun on my name, Hour with the H, or you can go to our kx935.com website, where you'll find not just my show, but all our other wonderful shows and offerings. For now, this is Sharon James, wishing you a great week ahead and hoping you'll tune in again for the Share An Hour every Sunday night at 6:00.